Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us here as we continue our rummaging through the big old binder of baseball cards. I don't know if you can actually rummage through a binder of cards, though. There's no rummaging. The cards are all nice and neat and organized. Well, whatever form of rummagement we have going on here, we are going through the 1967 top set. And I will be up front with you on this. That's just who I am. I don't BS. I'm just up front and honest with everybody. I've never been a big fan of 67 tops. Never. I've never been big on the design. I've never been big on the colors. Never been big on the pictures. And that makes me an outlier to a lot of collectors. There are a lot of people that love 67 tops. So I'm going to tell you why I don't like it as much as other people do. But like I said in 66 tops, this isn't the worst card that tops put out. No, there are some sets that are far worse. And I wouldn't even say it's, the worst set of the 60s in terms of design and all that stuff. I still believe that 61 tops lacks a lot. But 67 tops, a favorite for a lot of people, not for me. So we'll get into the reasons for that later on in the podcast. And we'll also talk about our random pull. Card number 230, Boog Powell. Yes, the original Boog Powell. Not related to the Boog Powell who plays for the Seattle Mariners these days. But this Boog Powell, better known as John Powell to his parents and family throughout Central Florida, big star for the Baltimore Orioles for much of his career, shiny happy face here on the 67 Topps card, and a world champion by the time that this card was released. In fact, the Dodgers getting stunned by the Orioles in 1966, getting swept in four straight in that World Series. I've got a big, big pile of books that I have to read sometime throughout the summer, maybe even into the fall. I got so many of them. Barnes & Noble's gift cards are great gifts for me, so I'll go out and buy some books, sports-related, history-related, you name it. But I recently made a trip to the downtown Tampa library. And like many public libraries, they have a used bookstore. And some people donate books to the library that they sell. The downtown library is so big here, though. Every few months, they go through their entire collection and just clean out books. And, I found some real gems there for $1.50 a piece. And these are hardcover, original price, $23 a book. And they just want to get rid of them and make a few bucks off of it. So I got a biography on Leo Durocher. I'm reading Billy Martin's autobiography. I've got several baseball books, including one about the 66 World Series. That's about three or four books down the depth chart, though. So when I do get around to it, probably in 3 or 4 months, I'll share that with you. But that was a stunning upset. The LA Dodgers were still a dominant team, and in fact were the defending World Series champions. They defeated the Twins in 7 games in 65. So to have Boog Powell, Brooks Robinson, and Frank Robinson, along with that great pitching staff, of course, a young Jim Palmer leading the way, and you had some outstanding arms in Baltimore for a few years afterwards. You had Dave McNally, you had Mike Cuellar. You had four 20-game winners in 1971. So an amazing story that kind of gets lost in the shuffle of baseball history. The beginning of a dynasty for the Baltimore Orioles, a team that won a World Series in 1966 and 1970 and appeared in the World Series in 1969 and 1971. Pretty good team there, and Boog Powell, one of the big reasons why. So we'll talk about Boog Powell. We'll talk about 67 tops after we talk about what you're talking about as we take a look at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. As always, I encourage you to share Wax and Gum Stains with all of your collecting friends, even those who don't really collect nowadays, but they collected with you when you were a kid 20, 30 years ago, however old you are. There's a lot of fun discussions going on here. A lot of great memories being recounted here. And of course, people talking about our podcast, about the individual sets and some of the players that we discuss. And that leads us to a comment from WaxPack916. Catching up on a few shows, great job. Thank you. 63 through 66 are my favorites from the 60s. It's astonishing that Oliva isn't in the Hall of Fame. Of course, talking about Tony Oliva, our random poll from the 1965 Tops podcast. And, you know, that was one of the frequent comments in response to our 65 Tops podcast. A lot of collectors love the set, and they're astonished that Tony Oliva is still not in the Hall of Fame. A lifetime 304 hitter, seven consecutive All-Star appearances, and has been with the Twins organization essentially ever since they set up shop in the Twin Cities in 1961. I'm really, really, really hoping the Veterans Committee later on this year does the right thing. Oliva came oh so close to getting inducted a few years back, just missed the cut. And I really hope he gets in there because not only is he a great player from his era, but he was certainly a big factor in the success of Kirby Puckett, as I've mentioned before, and has been a great leader and, you know, somebody that players can follow in the Minnesota organization to this day. Now, Kyle Benning, who recently followed us, thank you for doing so, Kyle, had this hilarious tweet that he sent to us yesterday. If you've listened to this show, you know my disdain for the manager card. And let me just briefly reset that conversation. This goes back to podcast number four, I think it was. Was it four? Yeah, podcast number four. When we started this whole show, we did it with the big old monster box, and it started with the 1981 sets and worked its way up to 1993. Well, the random pull, and I've got a few hundred 81 Donruss cards. The random pull for podcast number four, which was featuring 81 Donruss, was Red Shaindienst. And Red Shaindienst, much like Tony Oliva, an outstanding player, a mentor, still alive and kicking and leading the way in St. Louis in the front office, a longtime member of the Cardinals organization. He had a brief time in Cincinnati and Oakland, but most of his life has been with the St. Louis Cardinals. And as much as I appreciate and respect Red Shaindienst, if I'm pulling a card out of a random stack of 35-year-old cards, I don't want the manager card. And I've said, give me a set checklist card. Give me the team checklist card. Don't give me the manager card. And there are some people who make the argument, well, the manager card is the only way that I can get cards of some Hall of Fame players. And to that, I understand the argument. And I'll be honest with you, you know, one of my 67 Tops cards is actually Gil Hodges. I've always respected Gil Hodges as a player and as a manager, and who passed away far, far too young in life due to a heart attack. But it's Gil Hodges. He was managing the Washington Senators at the time, and it's a neat card. But, you know, overall, I just don't want the manager card. It's just, eh, so what? And in a lot of cases, the manager card featured a person who was fired by the time I pulled his card out of a wax pack. Now, there are notable exceptions, you know, Sparky Anderson or, you know, Davey Johnson during his time with the Mets, you know, Tommy Lasorda, of course, Walt Alston, if you want to go back even further. So, you know, there are some managers who kept their position with a particular team for a long time. But, you know, a lot of cases, you know, managers, what's the old saying? They're hired to get fired. And, you know, that's exactly why I could care less about a manager card in most cases. So Kyle sends us a great card, and he sends it over in two tweets, and I retweeted the second one with a comment. So his first tweet was, what's worse than pulling a manager card? How about pulling a special insert Rediscover Tops buyback manager card? But wait, it gets better. It's not like it's an 81 Tops Sparky Anderson, although they didn't do a manager card back then. They featured the manager on the team picture. But you know what I mean. You know, it's not a Tommy Lasorda or a Sparky Anderson, or you know, it's not like a 73 Tops Leo DeRocher card. It's not. No. Just pulled this from a fat pack of Tops Heritage Worst part is I have 15 copies of the original card from my days of devouring 89 Tops. And the card is Dallas Green, then, briefly, manager of the New York Yankees. And looks like it's the bronze stamp for Rediscover Tops. So this is very similar, and I shared the story when we were talking about 91 Tops. Remember, 91 Tops, that was the 40th anniversary set that Tops put out. And one of their big hooks to get people to buy more cards, even though the hobby was really almost at its pinnacle at this point in time, they decided to buy back a whole bunch of old cards and randomly insert them. Now, you could get a 52 Mickey Mantle. You could get a 68 Nolan Ryan. You could get a 65 Steve Carlton. So there were some pretty impressive chase cards. But a lot of the times, the throwback cards were cards that you literally wanted to throw back. You know, like a 89 Topps Toronto Blue Jays checklist. And Topps pulled the exact same shtick in 2006. They used to insert these cards in the rack packs, and it was the same thing. It was a common player from 86 Tops or whatever. So I'm not surprised that you kind of got a lame card here with the Rediscovered Tops, but the Dallas Green. And to make matters even worse, I mean, you got the ultimate womp womp sad trombone card here, Kyle, because Dallas Green's hat is airbrushed too. And of course, that's just the perils of having George Steinbrenner as the owner of the Yankees. I don't believe Dallas Green even finished the 89 season. In fact, I recall when Steinbrenner was booted from baseball for, I think it was a year, or maybe it was 2 years, back in the early 90s, Sports Illustrated ran a story about how Steinbrenner, in the 16 or 17 years that he was owner of the Yankees at the time, ran off every manager. And they took a cropped photo of every manager's head and had him kind of bouncing along the bottom of the page, you know, kind of like an off with his head thing, you know, lop off his head. So, you know, there were like five Billy Martin heads in this article. And I remember reading this as, you know, I guess maybe 12 or 13 year old kid and going, wow, how many times can you hire and refire Billy Martin or Bob Lemon or Dallas Green in this case? And God rest Dallas Green, who passed away not too long ago. And of course, Greeny was the manager of the 1980 Phillies, finally getting the Phillies and that incredible collection of crackpots that were on that team to come together and fight through a season and win the World Series in 1980. Speaking of books, there's a book about the 1980 Phillies that I read a few years ago. I want to say it's something like You Can't Lose All the Time. But if you're a Phillies fan, you may want to check that out. It's a very good read. But Kyle, thank you so much for sharing your Rediscover Topps manager card, and not just any manager card, but the 89 Tops airbrushed, soon to be fired Dallas Green. That, my friend, is a piece of collector's art right there. All right, if you want to chime in at any time, again, Wax and Gum Stains is the Twitter feed, and you can share us your thoughts about our podcast, about the sets we talk about the players we talk about, or just like Kyle did there, you could share a picture of the random poll that you made and that you will surely cherish. Frame it and put it in your bedroom if you want. Wax Ecstatic comes out with new episodes every Tuesday as we continue our splurge through the big old binder. And right now we're in 1967, so we will go up until 1980 Tops. And then we'll see where the podcast goes from there. I've got about 13 weeks to figure that out. But we will have, by the time the new binder podcasts are done in a few months, we will have gone through 1954 through 1993, skipping over 55 and 56 only because I don't have any Topps cards as of now or even Bowman cards from those sets. But I'm sure at one point in time I will. And We'll see where it goes from there, but the new episodes come out every Tuesday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern, via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, also TuneIn and Stitcher. So whatever podcast platform you're used to checking out your favorite shows on, chances are we are on it. And as I mentioned, the new shows come out Tuesday mornings. We have a Flashback Friday edition, which comes out Friday mornings at 10 o'clock. Give you a chance to listen back to some of the older episodes, especially if you're relatively new to the Wax Ecstatic podcast. And our most recent Flashback episode, the 91 Bowman set, one of the few Junk Wax era sets that I wish I didn't get rid of as many cards. I had probably 700 or 800 91 Bowman cards that went out with the great purge of, 12 or 13 years ago, where all those, or not all, but basically the common Junk Wax era cards, I found a shop to buy them off for me. And, you know, basically I just bought some supplies in return. And, unfortunately, 91 Bowman, much like 89 Tops, not for the Dallas Green card, but, you know, there are a couple sets that I kind of wish, you know, I probably should have just hung on to a few extra cards. And 91 Bowman is one of them. I remember when they came out, they were such an improvement over the 89 and 90 sets. And I still, you know, if you want to check out our archives at any of those platforms I mentioned, the 89 Bowman set and the 90 Bowman set deserve a much better fate. But the 91 Bowman set was just so improved, had some great rookies, great design. I bought a bunch of them up back then. I've toyed with the idea of maybe buying some now just for old time's sake and get them fairly cheap. But 91 Bowman was the year that Bowman turned the corner. And of course, 92 Bowman, they really stepped up their game and eventually became the set of the rookie card. And the Bowman brand is still alive and well now. In fact, the Topps Company, which still owns the Bowman brand, celebrating Bowman's 70th anniversary this season. And they've basically made Bowman, or have kept Bowman, the rookie set. You know, you still have some current stars, but now it's crazy. Some of the rookie cards that are in the Bowman sets, these are guys you're not going to see in the major leagues for 4 or 5 years in a lot of cases. But it really started with the 91 Bowman set. They took up their game in 92. And I really think 91 Bowman needs a little more love than it gets. So you could check that out or any of our archive podcasts, again, via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, or Stitcher. We've got your new episodes on Tuesday mornings there, and your archive episodes will feature a Flashback episode on Fridays, but all of the previous shows are up there for your consumption. I also want to mention we have a tip jar if you like what you hear on Wax Ecstatic. We do appreciate any cash contributions, and it doesn't have to be a big contribution. In fact, I joke, for the price of a case of 88 Donruss, which would be just a few dollars, you can keep Wax Ecstatic going strong. The direct link is paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. And when you click on that link, or if you type that into your browser, you will get directed to a PayPal page, and it says Matt Salmon, that's me, and there's a little Wax Ecstatic logo there. And it also says Lutz, Florida, which is the little town just north of Tampa that I live in. And more than happy to keep the podcast going strong with your contributions, even if it is just a few dollars. Again, we appreciate everything. We appreciate those who have already made a donation. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Again, I am not getting rich off of this show. Trust me, I am not making a fortune. We do have a few small production fees that just need to be covered, and every donation helps out. So again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you follow our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, you will see once or twice a week we will tweet that link out, and we do appreciate every contribution that we get. Now, something I'm toying around with, and we'll send out a tweet, and it's an interesting suggestion. I'm kicking this around, and it hasn't quite taken complete shape just yet. But I've had some people suggest that they send money, basically through the PayPal link. I go out and buy some products that they're suggesting, typically vintage stuff. And I'll do a pack open and kind of go through and just discuss the cards that are on there. And you know, basically send the cards back to the person who bought them. That is obviously a video component because it doesn't really do any good for me just sitting back here with a microphone. You have to really use your imagination on that. But that's something, I wouldn't say a Facebook Live, but obviously we can set up a camera and just do a quick video shoot with that. So I'm curious if people are interested in that. Or what we could do, and this is something, again, that was suggested that I'm willing to try. If I go out and buy some vintage stuff, so let's just say I buy a rack pack of 84 tops, all right? So I go out and buy it, and we basically put it up for bid. And then the highest bidder, you make the transaction. So let's say you bid $10, and that's the highest bid. Well, you send that to the Wax Ecstatic tip jar, and then I'll basically do the same thing. We'll open it up, we'll take a look at the cards, talk about some of the players, and talk about the card set just a little bit. If that's something you're interested in, please let me know. I follow most of the accounts that follow Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. So just send me a DM and say, Matt, yeah, I'm interested in doing one or both of those. Or you could just reply to the tweets that we send out. And I'm just curious to hear, you know, what you think. So again, a chance for people to suggest what I should buy. I will, with your money, go out and buy it and ship it off to you after we break the pack. Or if I go out and just buy some random classic stuff, basically put it up for auction, highest bidder will get the cards, and I will just kind of, you know, shuffle through the cards, and, you know, we'll do a live break via video. Or maybe it's not live, but at least I'll record it and share it with you. So just throwing it out there. It's an idea that, again, was brought up during the listener survey a few months back. Haven't really had time to put it into motion up until now. So this may be something that we try a few times during the summer, and we just kind of see where it goes. It wouldn't replace the podcast. It's just something extra for those really tuned-in fans to get involved with. And I think it's something that could be fun. In fact, I know I have in my possession a couple of 81 tops rack packs that have just been sitting in a closet. I could put them on eBay, but I mean, it's 81 tops, so I might get $5 for them. But that may be something where, you know, we put the rack pack up for bid before it goes, before it gets opened up. And then highest bidder will get all the cards that come out of it, and we'll just kind of do a video rack pack open. So it's something that I've thought about. Curious what you think about it. If you're not big on it, please let me know as well. If you think it's a waste of time, a waste of money, who cares? Let me know, because while some people have suggested it, others probably don't care about it. And at the very least, I know that it's something that you're really not interested in, and I don't want to waste your time doing it. So keep an eye out for those questions via Wax and Gum Stains, or like I said, if you're hearing me pose this idea right now, I would like your two cents. Just DM me and let me know what you think about the idea. All right, now I'm going to let you know what I think about 67 tops. I have never been a big fan of this set, and that's going to surprise a lot of collectors, because there are some elements of 67 tops that I look for in a card, but for whatever reason, 67 tops, in my opinion, didn't really pull it off the right way. Now, again, our random pull is card number 230, Boog Powell of the Baltimore Orioles. We'll talk about him in a moment. But let's take a look at the card itself, because this is very similar to what you see in a lot of cards. So we look at the front, and here is Boog Powell just smiling away for the photographer. Now, this is interesting. Even though this is a 67 tops card, I can tell you this photograph was not taken during the 1966 season. And I know that because of the Orioles hat that Boog is wearing here. That is the old Orioles hat with the bird, the profile of the bird tweeting away. That was the original Orioles hat from when they moved from St. Louis in 1954. Well, in 1966, the Orioles had changed their cap logo to the bird head, the cartoonish Baltimore Oriole head, which has made a comeback. The Orioles have been featuring that logo for the last, 4 or 5 years now, and it's very popular, mostly because people harken back to the days when the Orioles were winning World Series, not just in the 1960s, but also the 1983 World Series as well, and their appearance in the 1979 World Series, even though the Pirates won that one. People remember that particular cap. Now, we can also add some more intrigue here. That cap was not used by the Orioles in the mid-1960s. In fact, from 63 to 66, they didn't have this cap. They had a cap that just had a solid block letter B. It was probably the Orioles' most boring uniform. They just had kind of arched uniform that, you know, it just said spelled out Orioles in block letters, and they had that block B. So this may be a picture from going as far back as 1962, or Boog Powell just grabbed an old hat, and that's your story there. But anyways, here's Boog, and it's a very up close picture here. And Boog has also written his given name, John Powell, in the faux autograph at the bottom. Up top, you've got his name. You've got this little dot in between his name and the position. Now, in some issues of 67 Tops, that dot is missing, so it's a variation. And I think it was later print runs, so the variation is a little more valuable than the original. And then at the bottom, in big block letters, you've got the name of the team. And that's it. That's your card right there. Now, in many cases, I would like this because it is so simple. In fact, it harkens back to 57 Tops, which I absolutely love. But I think the big problem for me with 67 Tops is, again, remember, you know, I consider the glory days of Tops in the 1960s from 62 to 65 in terms of design, in terms of a wow factor. It stepped off a little bit in 66. They kind of played it safe there. In 67, there's really no design here. There's a very thin white border around the picture, but still 95% of the front of the card is devoted to a picture, while just a little bit of space is devoted to the player's name, his position, and the team name. Now, again, there is a simplicity to it that I like, but there's not really that wow factor. And I think what drags down the wow factor is the photography. Now, remember, in 1967, there were no action shots with the player cards. Sometimes you would see an action shot with a World Series or season highlight card, but the player cards were just headshots. A lot of them posed, a lot of them, you know, faking a pitch throw or a bat swing. So, you know, that was just status quo for the time. But 67 Tops really went overboard with the extreme close-ups of these players. Now, the Boog Powell shot is actually framed rather nicely. But if you look at a card like Mickey Mantle, you know, it looks like Mickey Mantle is in the back of a club in New York. Well, he might have been. But, you know, the zoom is just too tight. There's a flash bulb kind of in the background. It washes out the picture a little bit. And, you know, Mantle is just one example of the card photos that I think was just cropped a little too closely. Even Roger Maris or other players, and I've seen this through a handful of other cards from the 67 set, the pose shots were just cropped way too closely there. So you get to see your favorite players up close and personal, but I think it's a little too up close, and it kind of makes the set boring. I hate to say that because there's a lot of simplicity to it, which is something that collectors have clamored for years. But again, comparing it to some of the sets from earlier in the decade and, you know, comparing it directly to the 57 Tops set, I think 67 Tops, they tried a little too hard to replicate 57 Tops, and I'm not really that crazy about it. Now, with that said, you've got a lot of space devoted to a picture, and the letters from the player's name and the team name and the position, for the most part, do not get in the way of the pictures. That was one of the big complaints about the 64 Tops set. So 67 Tops, in my opinion, especially the front of the card, very simple, very clean, but kind of bland. And again, a lot of it just comes down to the photography. All these pose shots, a lot of them too tight, too close, and I'm not crazy about them. Now, the Boog Powell shot's actually pretty decent, as I mentioned, and it's not just in how it was framed, but it's a good picture of him. But a lot of the other cards, like if you just look through some random images of the 67 top set, you'll see what I mean, and especially the Mickey Mantle card. That's really one of the best examples that I can think of. Now, let's flip the card over. And this is something that really drags down the 67 top set. The avocado green backdrop. It is certainly memorable in the sense that if I were to just show you the back of a baseball card from this set, you would know it's from 67 because the folks at Topps, well, they only did this vertical presentation with the avocado green as the primary color once, and that would be 1967. Now, they did not get rid of the avocado green. It would come back with a vengeance with 71 tops, and you would also see a dark green in the 82 tops set, although I wouldn't say it's avocado, but it's kind of dark green. Green was a pretty prominent color in top sets throughout the 1970s. 76, 77, 79, they all had green backs. 74 did as well, and the 75 top set had green printing, kind of on a gray or white back, you know, with the gray cardstock. But green would hang around for a long time with Topps cards. This was the avocado green, though. If you are my age or slightly older, you remember everybody had a refrigerator, a dishwasher, a car, or shag carpet this shade of green. This was a color that was just dominant in the 70s, and most of us don't like it, so I've never really liked this green color. And it's a little hard to read, at least the narrative, because you've got the black on top of this dark avocado green. Now, the white text boxes for the stats and also for the cartoons that you see at the very top, well, those, you know, they stand out. They look a lot better. And, of course, a lot of that is due to the white cardstock that Topps was using at the time, which I do enjoy. But the 67 Topps backs leave a lot to be desired. And it all just starts with that avocado slash puke green. Now, for collectors who aren't necessarily looking for style points, but in trying to maintain their collection, the dark green backs are just the bane of this collection because they show wear and tear very, very easily. You have dark green ink on top of, you know, very crystal white cardstock. And you can see, even looking at the back of this Boog Powell card, it shows some wear and tear around the corners very easily. Now, it is a 50-year-old card, let's be honest here, but it does show the imperfections a lot easier than had this card been on a gray cardstock or had the card had a white border around this dark green color. So collectors, again, not looking in terms of style or design, but looking just at maintaining a pristine mint condition set, really don't like 67 Topps because of this. Now, there's a couple other reasons why they don't like the set, and I'll get to that in just a moment. But final thought on this Boog Powell card, and this has been a common theme in a lot of these 1950s and 60s podcasts I've been doing, and that is this card actually came from a set that I recently acquired, or I shouldn't say a set, came through a lot that I recently acquired. I found a local card store that had a guy come in and sell a couple of monster boxes of cards dating back to, I'd say, 1955. So again, one of these days I'll have some 55 and 56 Topps, but I'm not quite there yet. Going up through 1979, and I told you the story how I went in and got a lot of roughly 350, predominantly 78 Topps, but some from, I'd say, 72 to 79 mixed into this lot as well for $20. And I wasn't concerned about the condition. Found a couple of neat cards in there, 78 Topps, Keith Hernandez, Jack Clark as well. So some cards that could, you know, if you're looking for a dollar value, you could fetch $5 or $6 for them. But again, you know, I just don't care. It's just neat for me to go through this collection of cards and add to the already copious amount of mid to late 70s cards I've collected ever since I was a teenager. So recently I went back to this shop and I really like the shop. I like the owner, a good family guy. And he was able to give me such a good deal on the first set. I went back to the monster box, the second monster box, which featured 62 through 78, 79. And I just went through there and pulled about 10 or 15 cards from each year. Some sets, he didn't have a whole lot of cards, so I only grabbed what I could. But again, not really concerned about condition. Took the ones that were in the best shape that I could find, though. It's not like I went out of my way for a card that was drastically off-center or out of focus. And I walked away with about 80 cards from 62 through 69. No 68 tops, because I've got a lot of those from another lot, which I'll get to next week when we discuss 68 tops. But anyways, 62 through 67 and 69, I got 80-ish cards for $20. Again, so basically 25 cents a card for these great pieces of history. And I may share some photos from the lot because there's some interesting cards I did pull from there. Certainly nothing that's going to make me rich, but just some, in my opinion, some neat cards. And this Boog Pal card was one of them. It also helped me grow my 67 Tops collection quite a bit because I honestly had about five 67 Tops cards. So I've added about 15 more to it. But again, I strongly suggest if you're somebody who is listening to this podcast and going, wow, I've never really spent any time going through these cards from the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. As long as you're not too concerned about the condition of the card, and as long as you're not too concerned about trying to make a quick dollar off of these cards, you can find plenty of lots of cards available, be it at your local card shop or go to eBay, go to Amazon, go to whatever online auction site or sales site you go to and track them down. You know, again, you can probably find lots of, you know, 40 or 50 cards from the 50s and 60s for about the price that I paid, you know, about $20 to $30, depending on what shipping is. Now, the downside to doing it on eBay is you get, you know, some people that just jack the price up there, and then you have to kind of hold yourself back. You have to put a limit. Okay, I'm not spending more than $20 on this lot of card. And then once it passes 20, you've got to walk away from it because I've seen some of these lots go for as much as $30, $35, $40. And again, you're only talking about, you know, 40 cards that are in very good condition that are not star cards. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, should I really be paying a dollar for a low series common 67 Topps card? And the answer is no. You know, if you have that disposable income to throw around, then so be it. Buy what you want to buy. But if you want to be thrifty with these purchases, then you probably shouldn't be going for that. But for 25 cents a card, and most of these cards are in decent shape, they are beat up just a little bit. But to get a Boog Pal card like I did, or some of the other cards, which again, I'll share a picture of some of the gems that I found in that lot. Just follow Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. I'll send it out, if not today, then tomorrow. But it's a good buy. So if you're looking to get into this particular part of the market, look for those lots through an online auction site or just an online sales site or your local card shop, because the local card shop, they're not going to make their money off of a 67 Topps Boog Pal card number 230. No, the 67 Topps cards they're going to make their money off of is Mickey Mantle, Carl Yastrzemski, Steve Carlton, Pete Rose, the big rookie cards from that set, Rod Carew, and Tom Seaver. Those are the big dollar cards. All right, the common card, eh, so what? So they'll be willing to give it to you for pennies on the dollar, just so that they can make a few bucks and you can help them clean out some of their product. So I would highly suggest doing it. And it's really fun to hold these historical pieces of baseball card collecting and the great sport of baseball and get them for a fraction of the price that some people would want you to pay for them. Now, 67 Topps came in at a box-busting 609 count set that year through several series. And another reason why collectors don't really like this set, or I should say, one reason that drives them crazy, because like I said, a lot of collectors actually do like this set, but trying to put together a complete mint condition set is very tough to do, because the high series cards, which do include the Tom Seaver and Rod Carew rookie cards, are very, very, very hard to find. There are some people that have discovered that certain high series cards are almost you know, 3-to-1 less likely to be found in just a random assortment of cards. I know they're like 3 or 4 times less likely to be found compared to the lower series. So I'm not sure what happened with the Topps company in the latter stages of the summer of 1967. But for some reason, the last 100 or so cards in this set are very, very difficult to find. On top of that, you've got some interesting variations. I told you about the set, the later runs of the set, where the dot in between the player's name and position are missing. There's also an interesting proof card that is out there. There's some interesting conspiracy theories about this proof card, but Roger Maris, there is a proof card that had a blank back featuring Maris with the Yankees. Well, he was traded to the St. Louis Cardinals right before the 67 season started. Well, Topps was able to put out a cards version of Roger Maris's card in the 67 set, but it uses the same picture and is clearly taken in Yankee Stadium, and he's clearly wearing Yankee pinstripes. Now, in true Topps fashion, they didn't show him wearing the Yankee hat. It's a picture of Maris very up close and kind of shot from the chin up, so you see the underside of his hat, but you don't see the Yankee logo on it, and that saved them some time from airbrushing it. So there's Maris coming, you know, just under his hat with his name, position, and it says cards at the bottom, even though it is plain as day he's standing in Yankee Stadium. So if you can find the proof version of those cards, then that's something that does carry a significant dollar amount, because they are apparently available in pretty limited amounts. Also, a neat little thing that Topps did, just to shake things up a little bit in 67, if you look at the series checklist, it's not just a checklist, a laundry list of cards, but they would feature the head of a popular player and put that up at the top of the card. So you would have this floating head of Mickey Mantle or Willie Mays along with the series checklist. That's just kind of a weird quirk from that set. Now, the other interesting thing that was thrown into these wax packs, in the past they had done the cloth rub-offs or the embossed cards or the coins. Well, the 67 top set featured an all-star pinup, which sounds a lot sexier than what it actually is. It's basically a poster, like a 5x8 poster. I've seen a few of these before, not from 67, but from the 1970 set. And they're kind of neat if you can track them down. And because they were folded when they went into the wax pack, and chances are they were pinned up in somebody's room for many, many years, you rarely find them in mint condition. But that's a good thing, again, if you're not concerned about condition and you just want a really neat picture. You can find these posters for even just a dollar or two in pretty decent used condition. So all sorts of interesting quirks with 67 Topps. But, you know, like I said, I've just never been a huge fan of this set. Now, again, that's just my opinion. A lot of collectors will disagree with me. Yes, there is some simplicity to it, and there's some great rookie card power in Tom Seaver and Rod Carew. But overall, I'm just not blown away by the 67 Topps set. Again, it is not the worst set Topps put out. It's certainly not the best. It's okay. And this is one of those sets, too, that thanks to the Topps Heritage sets, and this was the template for the 2016 Topps Heritage set, I was able to slowly grow into the set and like it a little more, the 67 Topps set, that is. But again, this is one that I just have never really gone out of my way to collect, and really the exception this time, because I was getting a lot of cards, I just needed a handful more 67 Topps cards, because chances are we would have been doing another manager card with Gil Hodges of the Washington Senators, or Bruce Brubaker of the LA Dodgers. That was one of the other few 67 Tops cards. And I don't have too many interesting stories about Bruce Brubaker, with all due respect to him. I do have interesting stories of Boog Powell, better known as John Wesley Powell to his family and friends from the Lakeland, Florida area, not that far from where I'm at. Lakeland is about maybe 45 minutes east of Tampa. If you get on I-4 and head out towards Orlando, Lakeland is there. Lakeland, the longtime home for the Detroit Tigers spring training. They just recently remodeled Joker Marchant Stadium. They had to play at Florida Southern College the year before, but they debuted the renovated Joker Marchant Stadium this past spring to rave reviews. And Boog Powell is one of the early West Central, Mid-Central Florida baseball stars. I've mentioned before, especially the Tampa area, was cranking up professional ball player after ball player in the 1970s and 80s. Well, Boog was one. You know, he made his major league debut in 1961. He's one that you could see rising in the mid-1950s. In fact, he played for a Little League World Series team in 1954, he represented the Lakeland team along with his brother and a stepbrother. So you had two Powells and a Taylor. By the way, the Powell brother briefly played professionally, not in Major League Baseball. But his stepbrother, Carl Taylor, did make it to the major leagues late in the 60s, early 70s, had six seasons with the Kansas City Royals and Pittsburgh Pirates combined. So it's kind of neat how he wasn't just a standout star with the Lakeland Little League team that played in the World Series, the Little League World Series in 1954. But he had a couple family members that also climbed the ladder with him. Like I said, Taylor was able to make it, and his younger brother played professionally for a couple years but didn't get out of the minor leagues. So he comes from a pretty good baseball pedigree. And if there's one thing you need to know about Boog Powell, if you've never seen him, he's a big dude. Not Frank Howard big. We're not talking 6'7", 285 pounds. But even if you look at the back of this 67 Tops card, you can see he is generously listed as 6'3", 240 pounds. This was a raw power hitter. And that is what really got Boog Powell his claim to fame. Not early on in his career, because he had to deal with a lot of injuries early in his career, but once he finally had some healthy seasons, starting with that championship season in 1966, he really made a name for himself as a power hitter. Did have 39 home runs in the 1964 season, but was part of that great Baltimore team in 1966 that not only swept the Dodgers, but featured some incredible players. In fact, Powell finished in 1966 as the second runner-up in the MVP voting, second only to Frank Robinson and Brooks Robinson. Frank won the MVP for the American League in 1966. Brooks Robinson was second place, so the first runner-up, and then Boog Powell was right behind him. Powell, again, healthy for the most part in 66, finally got to play some complete seasons or near complete seasons in 1968. Through the early 70s, he was a four-time All-Star and in four consecutive seasons from 1968 to 1971. And again, power was really the name of the game for him. Had 34 home runs in 1966, as I mentioned, 37 home runs in 1969, 35 home runs in 1970. And then the injuries started taking their toll on him once again, playing only 114 games in 1973. And 110 games in 1974. Well, the Orioles looking to make a few changes by this point in time. Powell was a 33-year-old first baseman dealing with injury issues. The Orioles wanted to start bringing up some of their young prospects from the Rochester Red Wings of the International League. So they move Boog Powell in a trade to the Cleveland Indians. So they move him along with Don Hood for Alvin McGrew, who never got into the big leagues, and Dave Duncan, who did have a pretty decent career as a utility infielder, later better known as a base coach, especially with the Oakland Athletics in the late 1980s and early 1990s. 1990s. This was right before the 1975 season got started. And according to several reports that I've read, one of the big people who wanted Boog Powell, even though he was declining for the most part in his career, was the new manager of the Cleveland Indians. That would be Frank Robinson, his former teammate in Baltimore. And by the way, the Indians finally getting around to retiring Frank Robinson's number. I know Robinson was the player slash manager for the Indians for only, I think, 3 years and in some not so good seasons in the mid to late 70s. But having him as the first African-American manager in Major League Baseball, and for many years, I hate to say it, but he was the only one, you know, beyond Cleveland when he was in San Francisco and later Baltimore. It's amazing that it took over 40 years for that honor. But they recently did that, in fact, just a few days ago, retiring the number 20. So good on the Indians for coming around and doing that. And congratulations to Frank Robinson on that honor. Well, finding a little new life in his career, Powell played 134 games that season, hit a robust 297. That was one of his better averages in his career. He had 297 in 1970 and 304 in 1969. So it had been a while since he was able to put up numbers like this. And in the home run department, which he is best remembered for because of that power, 27 home runs. That was the most home runs he had since 1970. So even though the Indians were still a team in transition in 1975, the transition was complete for Boog Powell. He was actually the American League comeback player of the year in 1975. Unfortunately, Father Time does catch up with him. He was released by the Indians in 1977, right before the 77 season started. Signed as a free agent by the Los Angeles Dodgers, ironically the team that Robinson went to after Baltimore and before Cleveland. And then Boog Powell, his career ends after only 50 games with the Dodgers. He was released before the 77 season ended. 17 years in the big leagues, over 2,000 games, mostly at first base, 339 home runs, grand total of 1,776 hits, and he also had a career batting average of .266. Now, while he was a key cog for that Baltimore team in certainly 1966 and for their most successful stretch of seasons in the late 60s and early 70s, not good enough for the Baseball Hall of Fame, and I can hardly argue with that fact. In fact, he fell way short of the 5% margin for getting inducted or staying on the ballot in his first season on the ballot, so it was a very short trip for him. But that hasn't stopped Boog Powell. Boog Powell is still alive and well, 75 years old. He runs a barbecue joint. In fact, he is a renowned barbecue chef, if you will, has written some barbecue cookbooks. But the Boog's Barbecue is featured in Camden Yards. In fact, I believe it was there when Camden Yards opened in 1992. And he's got a couple other locations, but most people know it from going to Camden Yards for an Orioles game. And if you're wondering, how did he get the name Boog? You know, how do you go from John to Boog? It came from his father. Again, somebody who's living in good old Lakeland, Florida in the 1940s and 50s. A slang name for mischievous kids back then was Bugger. You've heard the name Bugger. People said, you know, that little bugger. You normally hear it, though, from European people. You hear it from Brits, you hear it from the Irish and the Scots. Bugger is a little different connotation over there. Let's just say a bugger is somebody who prefers going in through the outdoor, if you know what I mean. So it's probably a good thing that his dad didn't call him Bugger Pal. He just shortened it to Boog. So there you go. Boog Powell. It is not short for Booger. Close. It's kind of a slang for bugger, which in the southern United States in the 1940s was slang for a mischievous little kid. So that's how he got the name Boog. He actually goes by the name Boog, even though his legal name is John. And if you shout at him across the street, "Hey, Boog," he'll respond to that as opposed to, "Hey, John," because, you know, John's such a, you know, standard common name. And he's been known as Boog Powell for much of his life. And if you're wondering how the current baseball player got the name Boog Pal, it is because the current Boog Pal, who plays for the Seattle Mariners, his grandfather was a big Boog Pal of the Baltimore Orioles fan. So there you go. It kind of goes around in a full circle all these years later. So John Boog Pal, card number 230 from the 1967 Topps set, which I know I'm going to catch some heat for this. I'm not a big fan of. I know some people are, but I just have not been crazy about this set. I still do collect it. I still like to look at the cards. There are some neat factors to it, including the clean, crisp design. Even though I'm not crazy about the design, the fact that it is clean and simple is a good thing in my book. But again, this is just not a set that I trip over my feet to assemble. And it's a set where, I don't know, it's kind of like being hung up on an ex-girlfriend. You know, you kind of hung up on the designs from the earlier part of the 60s. I don't think, Topps was able to keep that going. It started in 66. They played it safe in 66. I think 67, they tried to do a lot of what they did in 57, but just, in my opinion, didn't come out quite the way that they wanted it. So that's my opinion. Curious what your opinion is at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Do you like 67 Topps? Are you like me? Do you not really care for 67 Topps? Are you one of those frustrated collectors who has tried to assemble a complete 67 Topps set, but have had trouble, A, with the very scarce high number cards, and B, with those avocado green backs, you know, with the condition of the cards not being quite what you expect it to be. Curious to hear what you say again at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, I'm also curious to hear what you say about 68 Topps, lovingly known by collectors as the burlap set, because there is a burlap bag design to it. While I'm not a big fan of 67 Topps, strangely, I've always liked 68 Topps. Despite the burlap look, despite the fact that there's only so much space devoted to the picture because the burlap sack takes up so much of the front of the card, but there are some things I really like about the 68 Topps set. If you're not familiar with the 68 Topps design, if you buy a pack of Topps Heritage cards from this season, the 2017 season, that is the template that's modeled after. I'd be curious to hear what you think about that, because I like the 68 Topps set. A lot of collectors don't like the 68 Topps set. But there's also a really neat connection through history that I've found in the 68 Topps set. And I will explain that in the next podcast. And it's just one of those neat things that baseball cards can do. You know, I've said before, these are connections not only to just old ball players and old teams and the great sport of baseball, but as a history fan, these older vintage baseball cards, these are pieces of history. They're not just cardboard. They will take you back to a time that you're likely not going to see again. Although, with the way politics are these days, who knows? We might be in a redux of 1968. But I will share that story with you. It's not that I ran into somebody popular or had, you know, some, you know, great historical vignette dropped on me, but it's just interesting how certain things happened at a certain point in my life a couple years ago, and 68 Topps baseball cards were at the center at it. So I will share that story. We'll do a random pull, and we'll talk about the 68 Topps set, a set I like, not so many other collectors like. That is in our next new Wax Ecstatic. That'll be coming out next Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern. Be on the lookout for our Flashback Friday episodes. We'll tweet those out all throughout the weekend. And also, be on the lookout for the tweets to our tip jar, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And also your 2 cents on people donating money for me to find some vintage packs, open them up, give you the cards, and just kind of talk about the sets. Or I will find some older stuff, basically put it up for auction, and then it'll be the same thing. We'll go through it and send you the cards and just kind of talk about some vintage wax, maybe even some junk era wax, which we know through this program is not junk. Well, in most cases. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next week.